Wow, extend out a little bit. I've already extended out. I think that we've been talking about some really tremendous things the last day and a half. And the first four chapters of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous are really about steps one and two. The first four chapters deal with convincing me that I am a compulsive overeater, or I'm not, but I am, of course. But what I really need to look at is the first four chapters tell me about the insanity of the illness. It tells me about the mental obsession, which tells me I can eat and the physical allergy, which makes that virtually impossible. And it tells me in the first four chapters, the doctor's opinion of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that there's only one thing that I can do to not eat compulsively. And the only thing that I can do is have a spiritual experience sufficient enough to bring about a recovery. Now, there's absolutely nothing in this world that I can do about the physical allergy. I will always have a physical allergy to food. If I ate certain foods today, I would be right back at it, worse than ever. Not as bad, worse than ever. The only part of the illness that I can attack with action is the mental obsession. And the only thing that will bring about a recovery from the mental obsession is a spiritual awakening sufficient enough to bring about recovery. And what do I need to do to bring that about? I need to take action. And I think that anytime I'm having trouble with a step, I must look to the step previous to it. I think that four is a very misunderstood step. And I think one of the things that makes four a very difficult step to understand is how misunderstood three is for me. Three was a very misunderstood step by me. I walked around these rooms, and I hear other people doing that too. I turned my life over to God 10 years ago, and I turned my will and life over to God, and I'm still as big as a hippopotamus. And I'm broke. And I don't have a movie star to make love to. And I don't have a fancy sports car. And I turned my will and life over to God years ago with no knowledge of what that really meant or no knowledge of what I was even saying. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in its wisdom and in its perfection, explains to me that before I am ready to do that, I must have some conclusions that I have come to that are on page 58 to start with. And it says on page 58, if you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. That is what I call step zero. Interestingly, that willingness and that decision is very crucial to my life. And on page 60, there's the ABCs. You know, I hear people, and I've done it too, they go into the fourth step and they haven't really done three. And the three things that I need to come to a conclusion before I'm ready to take the third step is that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. I am a compulsive overeater and I cannot manage my own life. I am a compulsive overeater. I have a physical allergy which makes it impossible for me to eat certain foods without creating an actual physical craving for more of the same. And it also means that I have a mental obsession which makes it impossible for me to stay away from those foods on my own unaided will. I may have stayed away from them for days, weeks, months, sometimes years, but I will always go back to them. Why? That's who I am if I default home. that no that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. Read the newspapers, go on the internet, look at the multimillionaire entertainers, the multimillionaire sports stars. Look at the people whose externals is to die for, and they are dying from addiction. Money will not buy this away. Fame will not buy this away. Acclaim will not buy this away. Sex will not buy this away. Only a spiritual experience will rid me of the mental obsession that no human power, if you gave me a Rolls Royce and you gave me $1 zillion and you gave me my own television program or my own multi-billion dollar company to run, it would not make this go away. Those things are very, very temporary. They are fleeting. And no human power could relieve my compulsion is a very important conclusion of the mind for me to come to. I get asked sometimes, and I've asked, how do you work steps 1 and 2? You don't. They're conclusions of the mind. They are conclusions of the mind. 3. That God could and would if he were sought as part C. How do I seek God? What do I do? What do I do? I don't know. So the book will tell me. If I knew how to seek God, I wouldn't be in this room with you right now. How I seek God is to move to him by taking action. The thinking part is over right now. I must take action. But why? Why should I take this action? Why can't I just go and not eat? I mean, I know all these things and I've read all these things. Well, there's a very important reason. My will and my life, what does that mean? My will is my thinking. My life is my action. If I'm going to turn my thinking and my action over to God, that makes more sense to me. My thinking and my action must be turned over to God. And what I need to be convinced of is that no life run on self-will is worth living for me. What was I hanging on to? What about my life was so fantastic? And many of you sitting in this room have wonderful things about your life that you are grateful for, as did I. I had good friends, I had some, I had good experiences, good memories. But what I have to come to is a conclusion that says my way does not work. And the big book is very explicit about this. In this part of the book, it's going to explain to me that I must quit playing God. I said last night, I had to be convinced of this. There is a God and it's not me. But if only my wife would do what I want her to do. Because I know she'd be better off. I wish Bruce was here because he knows my wife. If only my 12-year-old would do what I want her to do, I know she'd be better off. But my 12-year-old and my wife have a will of their own. And they have a thinking process of their own. And a lot of the times, their thinking and their desires and their needs and their wants are different for them than mine would be. And so then we come into conflict. And in those conflicts come my necessity to understand that I am not God. That they have a destiny and they have a self-will and they have a higher power too. And that it is okay. Sometimes when my daughter is making decisions that me and my wife are not crazy about, my wife will grab my arm or I'll just say to her or she'll say to me, let's just stay out of it. She has a God too. And that's so hard for me because I want to play God for me. I want to play God for her. And it is important for me to remember that if I'm turning my will, which is my thinking, and my life, which is my action, over to the care and direction of God, which was a word that they made Bill yank it out of this chapter, but the original manuscript was care and direction of God. And in the third step, if I make a decision, the decision is worthless unless it's followed immediately by action. Two frogs are sitting on a log. One frog says to the other, I think I'll jump off the log. How many frogs are sitting on the log?
Three.
Two. Because the decision to jump off the log will not get my rear end off the log. I must take action. I must take action. And if I don't take action, I will sit on that log for the rest of my life. Why should I take this action? Because my life doesn't work the way I'm running it. I'm full of resentments. I'm full of fear. I'm full of things that are killing me. And the conclusion that I must come to, the conclusion that I choose to come to, is God has a better way. What I didn't really know about myself is that I was scared to death. I was mad as hell. And what I had to learn is that that is what was killing me. The food was a symptom of the resentments that I felt. The food was a symptom of the fear I felt. The food was a symptom of the things that would go in my mind all the time, every day. And I would blame other people for hurting me. And I would blame other people for screwing me over. And I had to learn why I love a good resentment so much. Because while I could resent you, I did not have to take responsibility for my life. I could abdicate responsibility and blame you, and I could eat Illinois, and it was your damn fault in the first place. And as I replayed those resentments over and over and over again in my mind, I found out that I'm also a liar. You see, I had a very nice conversation this morning with some of the guys that are at this retreat about sports. I love watching sports. And I could watch the Bears against the New England Patriots Super Bowl 1,000 times. And I will never get tired of seeing it. And every single time they hoist Coach Ditka up on their shoulders and Coach Ryan up on their shoulders, it's exactly the same people doing it exactly the same way, and it never changes. Well, I have a thing going on in my head about what this one did to me 5 years ago, and what this one didn't do for me 3 years ago, and what that teacher did to me 40 years ago, and what this person did to me or said to me 12 years ago or yesterday. But I found out that as I replay those resentments in my mind over and over and over again, I'm not quite as true as the replay of a sporting event. Because I have something else in my head called an editor. And as I replay those resentments over and over and over again, each time I replay them, I change them just a little bit. And if I change them enough, and you give me enough time to ruminate those resentments in my brain, I will stand there as pure as the innocent driven snow, and you came along and you did me dirty. And it was your damn fault that I'm in this position, and I could eat ungodly amounts of food and do ungodly amounts of damage to my psyche and my spiritual life, and it was your fault in the first place. I love that. There is a fear I have of taking any responsibility for my life whatsoever, because I love to blame you. You dirty rat, you. I know why I love a good fear. Because, see, resentment always looks at what went on in the past and does magical things to it that kill me. And fear goes to the future. What if, oh my God, when they find this out, oh my Lord, what about this? Oh no, what about that? Oh no. And the future and the past are colliding in my head, and they ruin the present. Interesting word, the present. Another word that has many different meanings. Because every day God gives me a gift, and every day what I do with that gift is what determines what I give back to Him. He gives me a present. And if I ruin it with resentments, and I ruin it with fears, and I ruin it with food, and I ruin it by walking away from Him, I've destroyed the present. And so it works on a couple of different levels. Where do fears come from? Where do resentments come from? I had to know that too. And what I learned, and a lot of this is in the 12 and 12, the big book was written in 37, 38, came out in 39. The 12 and 12 is not the basic text. It's not the instructions for how to do this. But by the time Bill wrote the 12 and 12 in 53, he had really grown. And there's some great information on the basic instincts of life in the section on step 4. And it tells me where these things come from. And that there are three basic instincts of life. These instincts are God-given. They are immutable. And they are hardwired into us. And it is what we do with those things, those instincts, that makes us or breaks us. Anytime I combine instincts with ego, it will equal addiction. Instincts plus ego equal addiction. And so if I take these instincts and I utilize them to the point that God intended, then I can have a great life. If I take these instincts and I couple them with ego, I will be in trouble. The three basic instincts are the social instinct is the first one. We all have a God-given need to be part of a group. We all want to have friends. We all want to be popular. We all want to be accepted and loved by our peers. If we didn't have that instinct, we would never come together in groups. As cavemen found out, we can achieve more as human beings in groups than we can most of the time as individuals. And we find that to be true, or we wouldn't be in this room together right now. This is an ancient instinct. It is an instinct that goes back as far as when man first walked on the earth. And that instinct means I want to be accepted, let me be a part of, let me be the leader of. What is it that I need to do to be part of the group? And I work, and I get to be part of the group, and unfortunately it's just a temporary feeling. No sooner do I start hanging around with you guys than I think to myself, well, shit, who wants to hang around with you guys? So you guys look really good to me, but it's just a temporary thing. And so I try to go in with the in crowd over there. And I get in there, and that's just a temporary feeling too. Anything that is going to upset my fulfillment of that instinct is going to cause a fear or resentment. In other words, I want to be part of this group. Only I find out that Steve over there has been talking to Adam about not letting me be part of the group because he thinks I'm a jerk. It's going to make me fear Steve. It's going to make me resent Steve. And as I replay those resentments over and over and over again, it's going to effectively block God out. See, God can't get in my head right now because I'm busy resenting Steve. I'm busy fearing Adam. I'm busy resenting Adam, and God can't get in there. The social instinct also has ramifications when it comes to things like leadership. It has things to do with cooperation between people. The social instinct is a very, very strong instinct. What are people going to think of me now? What are people going to think of me if I'm dirt poor? What are people going to think of me if I'm wealthy? In other words, what is it that I need to do to make people like me and respect me and want to be around me or let me be around them? That's the social instinct. And anything that upsets my ambitions for the future in that area or threatens to take away what I already have in that area is going to cause fear and resentment. The security instinct. Same kind of thing. These things are very temporary. The security instinct is pocketbook, money. The things that I want to achieve in my business life so that I can have the things I want, so I can move my business forward, so I can create that comfort for my family. And these things, these instincts are God-given. And if they weren't, I wouldn't provide the things for my family that I provide. I am all in favor of living one day at a time. But I hope I'm not the only person in this room with a life insurance policy. I hope I'm not the only person in this room with a bank account. I hope I'm not the only person in this room that has certain things set aside for my future and the future of my family. These instincts to provide these things so that we could get through famines, we could get through bad crops, we could get through these tough times, they are God-given. But when I take that instinct and I couple it with ego and I become very, very desirous to take away what you have so that I can have it and take away what you have and what you have and what you have so that it's all mine, it becomes destructive. When that instinct takes over my life because of ego, it becomes destructive. So anybody or anything that is going to take away what I already have in the security instinct or threaten my ambitions for the future is going to cause a resentment and cause me to fear. And when I am full of fear and when I am full of resentment, God cannot get in my head because it's blocked off. I have effectively blocked God off. Once blocked off, I will return to my default mode, which is food. My brain will seek it out. It's almost like a machine. And if I've sounded repetitive so far this weekend, it's because that is the nature of this illness. Block God off, ego takes over, self takes over, food goes in. Block God, it's almost like a machine. If you keep putting God in there, those things can't get in there, and so my life works exponentially better. The third basic instinct of life has the same things. I don't want you taking away what I already have or my ambitions for the future in the sexual instinct. And that is the third basic instinct of life is the sex instinct. It is God-given. It is hardwired into us by God so that we will reproduce ourselves. If we didn't get the satisfaction from the sex that we get, we wouldn't do the work necessary for courtship. We wouldn't do the work necessary, and even the physical work itself, we wouldn't go through it. You can do more work, you know, having sex, if I remember correctly, you know, than you can doing a lot of other things. Why would we do that work? Why would we go through what we go through to do that? It's because at the moment of satisfaction, it feels fantastic. One of the greatest feelings in the world, and that's a God-given thing. Now I'm going to break and just say, my opinion is this. So please don't throw this in my face. I'm going to give you my opinion. Not bad opinion. I believe that God gave us the sex instinct so that we would reproduce ourselves. And I believe that God gave us the sex instinct so that we could enjoy it. But if we're using sex for something other than enjoyment or other than to reproduce ourselves, this is where we can get in trouble with it as people, and this is something that I will need to look at. For instance, am I asking somebody to do something in a sexual way that they've already told me they don't want to do? But am I bringing the heat? Am I using everything at my disposal to force them to do something they do not want to do?
Am I withholding sex to punish them? Are they Democrats and I'm trying to make them into Republicans and I'm going to cut them off at the pass until they think about things my way? Am I using sex for something other than what it was intended for? Now, the obvious thing is cheating on your wife or going outside your marriage or your committed relationship. That's a very obvious way that we hurt each other in a sexual way. But some of the ways that are a little more subtle is, are we using our sexual God-given powers of attraction because maybe we want to get in good with the boss, so we cultivate a relationship with his daughter? A relationship we'd really rather not be in, but we're entering into that to provide for our security instinct? That's not what sex is for. Are we utilizing sex to hurt another person? Are we in a sexual relationship that we'd really rather not even be in just to piss someone off because you know it will? That's not what sex is for. Are we in a sexual relationship with someone because we want to be in with the in crowd, or maybe we're just lonely and we just want somebody to pay attention to us, so we're in a sexual relationship we'd really rather not even be in, but we're using the other person because they beat nothing? These are the ways that we hurt others in a sexual way. And when we do hurt them in a social way, security way, sexual way, we create pain and suffering for them. They in turn will retaliate against us, creating pain and suffering for us, creating resentment and fear. And when the resentment and the fear go in my brain, guess what happens? I will eat again. Because I have blocked God off. And once blocked off, I will go back to my default mode, restless, irritable, discontented, and the only way my brain knows to make that feeling go away is to load me up with food. Now, what do I do about all this? I have a 12-year-old daughter. I remember when she was little. She used to love me. I don't know what happened. Now she tells me things like, don't touch me, don't stand next to me, and don't talk to me. I don't know what happened to her. But now that she's 12, or even when she was 4, if she was told to go clean her room, she wouldn't do it. My daughter's name is Hannah. Hannah, go clean your room. I might as well say, door, become an airmail. Brooke, turn into a hippopotamus. We'd have the same luck. But what if I went home to my daughter and I said, Hannah, go into your room and take everything out of your room that you no longer want, and I have an unlimited budget, and I'm going to replace everything you don't want anymore with something new and exciting. Whatever it is you want replaced is not a problem. There wouldn't be anything in that room but walls. And that's the promise God is making me every day. God is inviting me to rid myself of the crap that I have been hanging on to for decades. For decades, about what that teacher did to me, or that kid said to me, or that kid that didn't choose me for the team, or what my father should have done, or what my mother should have done, or all and on and on and on and on. And all it did was get me fatter and fatter and fatter, and unhealthy in many ways that are mental and spiritual. And I had a head full of fears and resentments and jealousies. And I had a head full of these things. And a person who is full of anger and resentment and fear doesn't feel good. And hence, the whole cycle would start up again. What do I do with this stuff?
I have to inventory it. It says on page 63 of the big book, it says, we were reborn. I am not the man that I was in my illness. The man in my illness would be of no benefit to you here. The only thing I would be interested in is in there, in the food, in the cafeteria. It is very important for me to come to this conclusion. I am willing to let God have it. I'm going to invite you to take the third step with me, if you want to. And it says, before taking this step, we thought well before taking this step. So if you haven't come to the conclusions of A, B, and C that I talked about, you don't have to say this, but I'm going to invite you to take the third step with me. Okay? You can say it along with me. It's on page 63. Okay? God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Release me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties and make victory over them. May your witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Amen. Now I've taken the third step, and I understand what it is that I'm turning over. And on page 64 it says, though our decision, a decision is the third step, it would have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us. Our food is but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. Our food is but a symptom. What was the cause? The resentments, the fears, and the sexual harms done other people. That is my problem. If you have a big book with you, and it's the fourth edition, I'm going to invite you to turn to page 551. If you have a big book with you, there's a third edition. The story is freedom from bondage. If you don't have a big book with you, then just listen. It's the fourth edition, it's 551. It's the third edition, I don't know.
544.
544. Thank you. 551, it says, I've had many spiritual experiences since I've been in the program, many that I didn't recognize right away, for I'm slow to learn, and they take many guises. But one was so outstanding that I like to pass it on whenever I can in the hope that it will help someone else as me. As I said earlier, self-pity and resentment were my constant companions, and my inventory began to look like a 33-year diary, for I seemed to have resentment against everybody I had ever known. All but one responded to the treatment. All but one suggested the steps immediately. But this one posed a problem. This resentment was against my mother, and it was 25 years old, and I had fed it and fanned it and nurtured it as one might a delicate child, and it had become as much a part of me as my breathing. It had provided me with excuses for my lack of education, my marital failures, personal failures, inadequacy, and of course, my alcoholism. And though I had really thought I had been willing to part with it, now I knew I was reluctant to let it go. One morning, however, I realized I had to be rid of it, for my reprieve was running out. If I didn't get rid of it, I was going to get drunk, and I didn't want to get drunk anymore. In my prayers that morning, I asked God to point out to me some way to be free of this resentment. During the day, a friend of mine brought me some magazines to take to a hospital group I was interested in. I looked through them, a banner across one featured an article by a prominent clergyman in which I caught the word resentment. Now here is the instruction that is going to go back to the step, but here she's using it right here. If you have a resentment you want to be free of, if you will pray for the person or the thing you resent, you will be free. If you will ask in prayer for everything you want for yourself to be given to them, you will be free. Ask for their help, their prosperity, their happiness, and you will be free. Even when you don't really want it for them, and your prayers are only words, and you don't mean it, go ahead and do it anyway. Do it every day for 2 weeks, and you will find you'll come to mean it and want it for them, and you will realize that where you used to feel bitterness and resentment and hatred, you now feel compassionate and understanding and love. It worked for me then, and it's worked many times since, and it will work for me every time I am willing to work it. That's the key. It will work for me every time I am willing to work it. Sometimes I have to ask for the willingness, but it too always comes. And because it works for me, it will work for all of us. Another great man says, the only freedom a human being can ever know is doing what you ought to do because you ought to do it. This great experience that released me from the bondage of hatred and replaced it with love is really just another affirmation for the truth I know. I get everything I need in Alcoholics Anonymous, and everything I need I get. And when I get what I need, I invariably find it's just what I wanted all the time. So what she's telling me in the story is, I've got to do it. I have come to realize in the area of these resentments, their futility and their fatality. These resentments will kill me. What am I hanging on to? I nurtured my resentments. I fed my resentments. Not only did I resent the person, but I would encourage other people to resent that person too. And then I would recruit other people to resent their families and the boat that brought them over here and the farms that their ancestors cultivated and all these other various things. For what? The payoff was only I was getting fatter and I was dying. These people, many of them were dead and buried in Waldheim Cemetery. Many of them were dead and buried, and I would reach down into the grave and do more things to hurt my mother. Not consciously in that text, but that's what was going on. Most of the people that I resented either were dead, they were not part of my life anymore, they didn't care. They went on with their lives. And I wanted to reach to them, and I formed a bond with them in my mind that was stronger than steel. In order for there to be a jail, there must be a prisoner and a jailer. And the jailer is as much a prisoner as the one that he has locked up. I had to stay there and guard the resentment. I had to stay there and shield the resentment from the light of reason. I had to make sure that the resentment had whatever it needed to flourish. For what? I didn't even know myself. It says, we have come to understand their futility and their fatality. These things were killing me. I had to get them down on paper. I had to go through a process of uncover, discover, and discard. Uncover, discover, and discard. List them in the first column. Who did I resent? What person, institution, postulate? What was the nature of who I resented? Who did I resent or what did I resent? In some cases, it wasn't just a person. It was my high school or it was this. In some cases, maybe you have resentments against laws or government agencies, whatever that might be. I had to list them and I do a 5-column inventory. Now, when do I do it? I do it at once. This is what the staff tells me. At once. No waiting. I'm either ready or I'm not. I either want to recover or I don't. I've got to get on with this thing. I love this gem. Work a step a year or whatever, you know. What is wrong? It doesn't say that. It says it has no permanent effect unless at once followed. Look, if I'm not ready to do it, then I haven't worked the steps previous. What am I waiting for? time. Well, I'm going to do this, and then maybe not. That would kill me. This is my opinion. My opinion. I'm either racing toward God or I'm racing toward the food, and there's no middle ground. I either want this or I don't. I'm either going to do it or I'm not. I'm either willing or I'm not. And there's no middle ground. There is no gray area. I want this or I don't. There's no gray area. There's no waiting. There's nothing. I must go. The first column is who or what did I resent? The second column is the cause. In other words, what did they do to me? In other words, why am I mad at them? What did they do or not do that pissed me off? The third thing is, what basic instinct did they affect? In most cases, I had more than one instinct that was affected by a resentment. In some cases, there was just one instinct, but in most cases, there was two and sometimes all three. Any resentment that I had against my wife would always affect all three. Because my wife is not only my sex partner, she's my business partner. So if I have a resentment against Esther, my wife's name is Esther, then it's going to affect my social, because if I'm not married anymore and I happen to go out and get divorced, or I'm having a great deal of difficulty in my marriage, what are people going to think of me now? What's her family going to think of me? What are her friends going to think of me? Those are the various things that affect not only my social instinct, but they affect my sex instinct as well. She's not too keen on having sex with me when we're in the middle of one of our loud discussions. And it's going to affect my security instinct, because she is also my business partner. She is the executive vice president of the company that I own. And so that's going to come and it's going to affect me in all of those areas. And so it isn't usually for me just one area that is affected by a resentment. In my case, and maybe in yours too, most of my resentments affected one, two, or three areas, more often than not, two, if not three. Now, I've got these things listed. What am I going to do with them? Well, on page 67, it gives me the specific instruction. This is why you can't work the program, guys, out of 12 and 12. This is why you can't work the program out of other sources, in my opinion, because this is the specific instruction manual. This is what was written to tell me what to do, when, and how. And it says on page 67, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. Oh, brother, I don't want to do that. In other words, what did I do to set this in motion? I have a resentment against somebody. What did I do or not do to set this in motion? In some cases, nothing. In 99.99999% of those cases, I either took action or omitted action based on my selfishness, my self-seeking, which we're going to get to in a minute, based on my fear that caused the problem in the first place. And so the first three columns are in the, it's all in the big book. Who or what did I resent? What did they do to me? What part of self is affected? Basic instincts. The fourth column is now going to make the first three columns lies. It's going to change forever how I view the resentment. Because now I'm going to take stock honestly of my part in it, and I will never be able to look at that resentment the same way again, because I have to remember I had a part in this too, that somehow I conveniently omitted or forgot. Oh yeah, I didn't do such and such. Oh yeah. And I can couple that with oh yeah, but. And when I do the oh yeah, but, I'm going to be right back into the food. Because now I'm blaming again. Oh yeah, I was supposed to do this, this, and this. wild. That's why she was so angry at me. I never did this, this, and this. And the fifth column is very simple. Here are the defects of character spelled out. Selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. Liking pickles is not a defect. Being this fan or that is not a defect. All actions that I take that are destructive are going to stem from selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. What's the difference between selfish and self-seeking? If I'm selfish and we land on a desert island together and I have all the supplies, I'm going to keep them for myself. That's selfishness. We land on the same desert island and you have all the supplies and I try to coerce you out of them for my own needs, then that is self-seeking. Selfish and self-seeking. I want to keep everything for myself, I want to afford everything, or I want to get what you have away from you. I want to weaken your position to aid me. And when I look back through my life, everything stems from my inability or unwillingness to be honest, my unwillingness to let someone else have theirs, to share, and my inability or unwillingness, rather, to be honest. Those are very difficult things for me. The fear inventory, as was just talked about by Bill, basically the same kind of thing. What's going to come up in my fear inventory is on page 68. We reviewed our fears thoroughly. One of the things that is going to come up in my fears is I fear that I didn't pay back so-and-so money I owed him 20 years ago. What's he going to do if he sees me? And a lot of this, as you can see, is going to be everything I'm going to need to do 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 in one sitting. There's no reason for me to delay any of this. I'm either ready or I'm not. I either want this or I don't. We reviewed our fears thoroughly, and what did we do? We set them on paper. I need a written inventory. We set them on paper, and we asked ourselves why we had them. I fear Sam. I fear seeing Sam at the party in a month. Why? I owe Sam $30,000, and I'm afraid he's going to confront me about it. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Why wasn't I paying Sam back? Because I was selfish, I was dishonest, I was self-seeking. I could have been sending him checks every month, but instead I used that money for food, or I used that money to go to a ball game, or I used that money for something I wanted. And I kept thinking that someday I'll pay Sam back, and now I'm going to see him in a month, so I'm either going to ditch out on this event, or I'm going to see Sam and I'm going to be scared to death. And these fears block God off. I must inventory my fears according to the big book. I must do the sex inventory according to the big book. And I must ask God for direction. I must ask God for direction in these areas. And there's prayer in four. We hear about the third step prayer, we hear about the seventh step prayer, we hear about other prayers. There's the fourth step prayer on page 67, where it says, this is a sick man, how can I be helpful to him? God save me from being angry, thy will be done. That's at the end of the resentment section. But that is the fourth step prayer. The big book instructs me, I must pray for the people and the institutions I resent, that they have everything in their life that I would want in mine and in the same measure, even when I don't mean it, as we just read in Freedom from Bondage. I must do this or I will die. I must do this or I will eat. I'm willing or I'm not. It's black or it's white. I needed to stop seeking middle ground, that gray. I needed to stop wanting to stop and wait. What I really was saying was, I'm unwilling to do this.
And when I'm done with my fourth step, I must give it to another person. And what that forces me to do is expose myself to that person in a way I'd rather not do. I don't want you to know that I wrote bad checks. I don't want you to know that I lied when the truth would have been better. I don't want you to know who I am at the very real core. And what I find out in doing step five is it's okay that you're the same person. Maybe what you did or how you did it was different, but it's the same thing. We're all one. I've probably heard nothing from a fifth step that was that outlandish where I would say, well, that person is the only person in the world that manifested illness that way. Six and seven, the defects of character. What are they again? selfish, self-seeking, dishonest. It's on page 67. Either I'm ready to have my defects of character removed or I am not. There's no waiting. There's none of that. It's do it or don't. Do it or don't. And if I don't, I'm going to eat. And that's the bottom line. Now, before we break off, what I want to say about steps 8 and 9 is very, very important to me. I heard a lot of people. Now, if you had asked me that when I was still hurting them, I would have told you that they had it coming. Or I would have told you, gosh, I don't mean to. Or I would have come up with some plausible excuse so that I didn't have to face myself. I would have come up with something so that I could avoid. That's who I am in my base nature. I avoid things. I don't like to be confronted. And I don't like to confront unless it's something new. If you're taking away my food, I'm going to confront you. And before I go to 8 and 9, I just need to remember that I have to demonstrate willingness in having my defects taken away. The prayer for that is on page 76. And I need to remember that this is a God-given program. And that if I did these things to these other people, I must be fearless and I must be thorough and I must be willing to go in there and to do the things that are very, very necessary so that I can make the amends, because I need to be able to walk the streets without the fear that I'm going to see you. I need to be able to walk the streets without the fear that you think I'm a dirty bastard. You might think it anyway, but I cannot give you further reason to think it. I cannot give you further reason to think that I've harmed you in some way. I must be willing to make amends. I must look back on my financial amends. Now, I didn't kiss anybody's girlfriend and I didn't kiss anybody's wife. Too bad for me, I guess. But I didn't kiss anybody's wife and I didn't kiss anybody's girlfriend. But most of the amends that I had to make were in the area of financial restitution. What I couldn't do was pay everybody back in one fell swoop. What I had to do was work out payments with them. In every single case, that was fine. In a couple of cases, I could not find the people. I made charitable contributions, guessing that this would be something that would work, and so far it seems to. Because I just couldn't find it. Even with the internet and everything, I couldn't find it. What about the amends that I needed to make to my parents, who have been dead for a long time? What about those amends? How do I make them? I wrote them beautiful letters. First letter I wrote them got torn up. I typed in a letter. But I wrote them out, and it was beautiful. But I also make amends to them in another way. I make amends to them, and I pray for them that they be resting in heaven.
And I get a very strong sense of what they would have wanted if they were here today. They've been gone over 30 years. My parents. They've been gone an awful long time. And for a very long time, I realized, or I thought I realized, that I had been dealt a dirty hand with parents like this. And it took me about 10 years in program to realize I didn't choose them. And it took me about another 10 years in program to realize they didn't choose their stations in life either. That if they could have been Robin, Laura, Petrie, they would have been. If they could have been like on Leave It to Beaver, they would have been. My mother did not choose her mental illness. My father did not choose having to come to a country he knew nothing about. He did not speak the language, nor did he understand the customs. He was a stranger in a strange land, thrust upon our shores in circumstances that he did not choose, nor did he want. He was bitter, and he was damaged, and he was injured, but he was my dad. And one thing I know is that he loved me very much. He just couldn't give me things that I thought I deserved. But he gave me everything he did have. He gave me love. He loved my friends, and they loved him. My mother was a loving and gregarious woman when she was really in the room, and a generous person. And how I make amends to them is to celebrate those things in their life to my daughter so that they will know from where they came. I make amends to them by attending meetings of Overeaters Anonymous and abstaining one day at a time because I'm the only child they ever had together. And they love me and would want me to recover in this wonderful program. I make amends to them when I'm walking early in the morning. I walk 6 miles a day, 5 days a week, 4 miles a day, another day, and I'll do it another day. But when I'm walking or working hard or moving our business forward, I sense their presence. I sense their pride, their love, and their satisfaction in a way I never could have sensed it when I was in the food. How do I make amends to myself? I took a little boy and dragged him through the muck of this insidious illness. And I cut that little boy off from everything that was rightly his. I took that little boy, that little innocent boy, and I made him into a fat freak. A sight. A spectacle. The object of ridicule. The object of insane eating. How do I make amends to that little boy? By doing the work necessary to recover. I cannot say enough that today I feel through the program, yes, there are decades of my life gone, but this is what I know. I know it. If I work this program, I will live until I die. And if I don't work the program, I will die until I stop living. I have the God-given right to live until I die. I'm alive because of the freedom that the program possesses. It's no wonder that the so-called promises of the program, as was read by Bill yesterday, and today read, are between steps 9 and 10. I cannot think I'm going to tap into those without working the first 9 steps. It's not going to happen for me. The freedom that the 9th step gives me is like an emancipation proclamation in triplicate, exponentially more than I ever could have imagined. The freedom that this gives me to live my life without worrying and fearing who I'm going to see or where they're going to be. It says direct amends. I confront, I talk to. Because if I just send you something, I don't know how you've reacted.
and want to get the feedback.
I am unable, with my limited vocabulary, to describe to you what it feels like to be in my skin today, seeking recovery. But like my daughter and her mythical promise of something new with an unlimited budget, I feel the gifts that God has given me. And all of the things that I gave God, He gives me something back that's even greater, even more wonderful than anything I could have given Him. And I feel that every day of my life. The program does not teach me how to have what I want. It teaches me to want what I already have. And that is so hard for me sometimes, because even now, I will look at someone else's house and someone else's life and someone else's car and someone else's wife and someone else's child and think this thought: if I had it or that or her or them, my life would be exponentially better. And then I have to quiet that down by saying, if God wanted me to have it or her, I would have it or her. I don't have to sit and pray, God, give me a new car. If God wants to give me a new car, I'll be driving it. Because God is that powerful. I have a new car. It's not a Rolls Royce, but it gets me where I want to go. So, I really need to say that this process works for me. And I guess that's enough out of me until later on, so we'll break it up.